Good morning and welcome to the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. If we can have the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Petizawatun, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
I'm here.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor?
Present.
Representative Wasilik?
Present.
Representative West?
Okay, and I believe we have a quorum. It may have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting.
Right. So moved.
Representative Pryor moves approval of the minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? I'm hearing none. All in favor of approval of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? Okay, the minutes have been approved. So, members, we spent our first 2 weeks, I don't think you did get adjustment on the sound, working on it, huh? Okay. We spent our first 2 weeks laying the conceptual foundation for our work. We've heard about brain development and prenatal care and birth and state policies related to those topics. We heard, okay, well, we're trying. And we then heard about the economics of child care and how things are working in our state and state data on those topics. I know I don't know what's going on. And so now we're going to be turning to the programs that our state has in these areas so we're going to be hearing about the CCAP program today in DHS. Okay, we'll try this a little bit more here with the microphone. So we're hearing from Department of Human Services regarding the CCAP program and MDE on Thursday regarding the programs in that department. So I think I'll try to turn it as quickly as I can to the department and then hopefully get the microphone situation switched. So do we have the folks from DHS here to present? Great. So if you could identify yourself for the record and then please proceed with your presentation.
Certainly. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Lori Posine and I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. Making sure I can't see the screens very well, so I'll trust they're working.
We can see them.
All right. The Child Care Assistance Program, it has two goals. It helps families pay for child care so that parents can go to work or school. And it helps ensure that children are well cared for and prepared to enter school ready to learn. Those goals are actually set in federal law and actually have been long time supported in the goals set for Minnesota as well. We serve about 30,000 children and 15,000 families. 68% of children are children of color or American Indian children, and 60% of those served are age 5 or younger. There we go. All right. How are we funded? Well, the Child Care Assistance Program in fiscal year 18 spent just over $266 million, and a little less than half of that was federal share, which is comprised of Child Care Development Fund dollars and TANF transfer. In that fiscal year, there was about $138 million of the state share and $2.94 million of county share. CCAP, as it's known, is administered at the local level, counties. Some counties use subcontracted agencies, And two tribal nations are administrators of the CCAP program for their tribes. It's supervised by DHS. We develop policy, of course, draft proposals. We interpret federal law and oversee implementation. DHS oversight also includes training that we conduct for workers at the local level. We create forms, manuals, we do reporting, we do audits, and we offer technical assistance and guidance about questions that we get from county workers, the community, providers, families. But families do apply at their local agency, and that's where determinations for eligibility are made. It's also where waiting lists, which we'll get to in a little bit, are maintained when needed. Providers interact also at the local level, and that we'll get into that a little bit more too, but that is, for instance, where their bills are submitted and payments are made for CCAP. But the payment itself comes from DHS in the form of a warrant or an electronic payment. So who can get CCAP? A family of three must earn less than $33,288 a month to qualify. And that's gross income. A few deductions we take into account are medical or dental costs and child support paid out by the family. But other than that, gross income is the determining amount that we use. We have different income and exit levels, and I'll show some examples of those in a minute. But the exit level for a family of three is just over $4,600 a month. Parents are required to be in an activity, which can include work, school, or job search. And one thing that changed during the federal law changes in 2017 that were enacted by the legislature is that during a 12-month period, most families would remain eligible as long as their income stays below the guidelines. The exception to that is if they do go into job search, we have what we call extended eligibility, which is 3 months of eligibility. If at the end of the 3 months they're not in activity, then their case might be suspended, and they wouldn't get benefits during that time, and they might be able to come back to the program. Parents must cooperate with child support. If there's a parent not living in the home where a child support case would be set up, and we do serve children through age 12, with the exception being age 14, if there's a child with a special need. So this is kind of a grid of those entrance levels. To make things even more confusing, in Minnesota, we have an entrance level and two exit levels. How that works is that during that 12-month eligibility time that I talked about, there's the 85% exit level, and this was a federal law change that said that states had to allow families to stay on until their income reached 85% of the state median income. And Minnesota had the 67% exit level in law, so essentially we retained both. So what that means is after 12 months, if a family's income is at 67% or more, then they would not remain eligible for the program. So as you can see, like a two-person family, one parent, one child, it's just over $15, about $15 an hour, for instance, you have to make to get into the program. And then families do pay copays most often. Below poverty level, there is not a copay, but most families do pay some copay. And this is just a sample of the copay amounts. So the copays are paid to the provider, and they're paid biweekly. So these are just examples of a family that might pay $24 every 2 weeks at about $21,000 a year, and about $44,000 a year at the closer to the exit level. They might pay 117. I'm sorry, that's not the exit level. Sort of mid-range. The 117 every 2 weeks to qualify. The Child Care Assistance Program is essentially administered as one program, but there are two streams of money to fund the program. What we often call the MFIP Child Care Program, it's for families who do receive MFIP. It's forecasted, so there's not a waiting list. Families that qualify can be approved, and as long as they meet other other eligibility guidelines, they're going to get their child care assistance approved. And then we have what we call transition year. That was set up so that when families left MFIP, there was a guarantee, if you will, that for at least 12 months that a family would continue to be served. And that's also part of the forecasted program. We have transition year extension. If a county has more than a 12-month waiting list, 12 months might not be enough. So transition year extension, which isn't specifically mentioned here, but that's really part of that same transition year program. So transition year, in a way, is kind of a misnomer. Because really how it would work is that a family would stay on the program as long as they remained eligible until their name came up on the waiting list. So if you weren't on cash assistance, or you hadn't been for a long time, basic sliding fee would be the program you would apply for, and that serves essentially other families with low incomes, and it's a capped allocation, so you'll often hear about a waiting list in counties. The number of the waiting lists, number of families on the waiting list has gone down, which is a bit of a, I think there's a kind of a convergence of issues going on right now. You've seen historically numbers, it's been even higher than the 6,000 shown here, but there's been a convergence of issues. There was, the way we manage the basic sliding fee allocation is we try to take available both state and federal funds and spread it out within a few years so that counties don't experience ups and downs of funding, and we reallocate money when there's money not spent from a previous year. It's very difficult for counties to manage spending within 1 year. Things aren't always very predictable. How many families will stay on the program? What are the ages of the children served? The cost of care might vary that families choose when they get on the program, predicting like how many you send out 100 applications, how many will you get back? It takes a while to approve them and to kind of bank that money so that you know how many families you can serve. Once a county serves a program, a family, and they're accepted into the program, the county is held to keeping them on the program, and so we don't bump families off in mid-year, for instance, if you run out of money. So it's very tricky for a county or local agency to manage that. And so like in legislative years when changes are made to the program, we try to help counties predict costs, if they might go up, if it stays the same, go down. But that's kind of a factor of why the waiting list, I think, is at a lower number right now, because there's just this convergence of issues of a little bit more available in the current allocation, and then some changes to the program that have stabilized costs for now. Let's look at how what parents choose when they choose childcare under CCAP. We pay a little over 3,000 providers a month. Families come in and they are referred to, if they don't know who their child care provider might be, they are referred to use Child Care Aware, Parent Aware search tool to search for child care, and their worker might help them also find ways to search for child care, and so they choose a provider, and we've seen over the years increased use in center-based care. We're at just over 70% last fiscal year. of families using licensed care. License-exempt centers, these are largely school-age programs, might be in a school district, a park program, or a nonprofit. And that's the 17%, or I'm sorry, that's the 11% number. And then you see about 17% are the licensed family child care provide, are some licensed family child care providers in Minnesota. And then we have that little sliver of legal non-licensed providers. And to be legally non-licensed, you have to serve your own children, perhaps, and then no more than one other family's children. And then you have to register, which I'll get into in a minute. You do have a background study as a licensed, unlicensed provider, for example. So those are the types of providers being chosen by families. Part of the presentation I wanted to focus on, because we were asked to make sure we covered this, is what are the processes for providers when they get into, when they're asked by a family, would you participate in the child care assistance program so that a payment can come to you on behalf of my family? A provider has to register. By that, we mean they fill out forms, they provide some policies that go along with how they charge families, and that is done at the local level. So a provider registers. If you're licensed or certified, there's really nothing else you need to do because you've already met training requirements, background study requirements, for example. So the process is fairly straightforward. For legal non-licensed providers, as I mentioned, they're not monitored by licensing. They are newly subject to annual inspections if they serve non-related children. They, in order to be paid, though, the background study has to be completed first, and some training needs to be taken before as they register for CCAP, for example, first aid and CPR. And depending on the age of the child that they serve, they might take SUID or sudden infant death syndrome training, as well as abusive head trauma. Those are, we have a number of courses online and free and in multiple languages. A provider, once they're registered, will receive, for eligible families, authorizations, and then billing forms. And if they choose to, they can be paid using electronic transfer, you know, bank transfer or electronic deposit. They can bill via paper voucher or using PRO, which is an online billing tool. And when they do get paid, it's most often within 10 days or less. The law is 21 days, but the data we show shows over 80% of providers are paid within 10 days. So some key policies that affect providers, in other words, kind of what do you have to do under CCAP that you don't do if you're not serving CCAP families? You do have to keep attendance records daily, and actually that is also a licensing requirement. So that's actually a kind of a dual policy for licensed providers. But all providers have to keep attendance records, and they have to keep them on site, actually for 6 years. They have to be available when people ask for them as well. And people could be an auditor, a county worker, those kind of requests. In the case of licensing, it would be a licensor. In order to get paid by CCAP, they should bill within 60 days of service. Most providers bill much more quickly, and they need to charge what they charge all families. And then if a child is, in terms of like reporting, if a child misses care for more than 7 days in a row or attends less than 50% in a month, they have to let the local agency know. And then from there, it depends on, they get a hold of the family and they find out what's happening. And if needed, like if the child has left, they would get a notice, and the family may or may not be choosing, you know, moved on to a different provider and didn't notify the provider. That's not very common. More often, it might be extended illness. As I mentioned, payments, they are made directly to providers for eligible children. CCAP pays what we call maximum rates. We'll get into that in a minute. We pay either the provider's charge or the maximum rate, whatever is less. Parents pay their copay to their provider. The copay is based on income and family size. And providers may charge parents for what is not covered by CCAP. That might be the difference in rates. It might be fees or other charges that are not covered within the CCAP rate structure. In terms of absent days, CCAP does reimburse for up to 10 holidays and 25 absences per year per child. And if there's a medical exemption, which can be achieved a number of ways with a medical professional signing a form, if a child has a chronic illness or an extended illness, they can get exemptions to pay more than 25 absences in a year.
Ms. Pusine, I think we have a question for Representative Pryor.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Just something you just mentioned, 10 holidays. Are they set which days they would be, or could they vary by the group of children that you're serving?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Great question. It's 10 designated holidays, except they can substitute. So as long as the parent needs to be aware of what they're substituting, so it can't be more than 10. But for instance, if there's a holiday that is recognized for that provider or in that community, they can substitute the 10.
I think Representative Franson has a question as well.
Actually, it's more of a statement. It goes by the provider's contract themselves. So if the provider does not get reimbursed for holidays, then CCAP would not reimburse as well because that contract goes to the county worker, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. Also kind of following that same rule of thumb of not charging CCAP more than the family.
Good to have an expert on the committee. Ms. Pusine, please continue.
Okay. Maximum rates. Maximum rates are always a puzzle to explain for child care assistance, but they are informed by a survey that we conduct every other year. And they vary by provider location, provider type, meaning which of those four provider types that we mentioned at the beginning, where they are geographically, the age of the child, infant, toddler, preschool, school age, and whether it is hourly, daily, or weekly. And so those are how the rates have been structured. I'll get into some examples of rates in a little bit. We do recognize up to 15 or 20% higher maximum rates when providers have certain credentials or including accreditation, or if they have a 3 or 4-star parent aware rating. Right now, maximum rates were at last updated in 2014, and those were tied to a 2011 survey. Based on 2018 rate survey data, the current maximum rates fully cover 16% of the prices charged by family child care providers and 23% of the prices charged by centers. To clarify that, it means if you collected all the data, which we did, of the providers who responded, who told us their prices, their hourly, their daily, their weekly, or their other rates, and we compared them to what our rates are, 16% of the rates, for instance, collected by the family child care providers were fully covered by the CCAP rate. They might be a dollar different, they could be $100 different, but in terms of fully covered, we cover just 16% of all the rates presented to us by providers, and likewise for centers.
So Ms. Pusine, I've heard that rates are set at 25% of the 2011 survey, and I don't see the 25% on any of your slides, but is that essentially what's driving the reference to 16% and 23% there? I mean, can you just sort of spell that out a little bit for us?
Yes. The 25th percentile, was what rates were tied to at the time that the last rate change occurred in 2014, again based on 2011 data. So what's happened since then is we've moved away from the 25th percentile and covered less each year of the full rates provided by these providers who've reported their rates.
So the rates, if I'm understanding you then, in 2014, the rates were set at the 25th percentile of the 2011 rates, and then since then, just those rates have stayed the same, and of course, costs have risen, which means the percentile has gone down. Am I saying
yes.
that right?
Yes.
And then I had one other question on this slide. What kind of credentials are referenced here other than accreditation that cause a provider to be able to get that increased bump in rates?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Committee members, that's a great question. Family child care providers, this goes back to prior to Parent Aware, there were two things recognized in some previous rate differences for providers. One was accreditation, which mostly was available to centers. There is a family child care accreditation that was recognized and still is in law. But by credentials, it means certain degrees. So a CDA, a child development associate, and then maybe a 2 or 4 year degree in early childhood. And this impacts mostly family child care providers.
And one other question on that, and then I know one of my colleagues has a question. So then that 15% to 20% bump is based on the rate such that maybe in that case, it rather than being 16% for the family child care provider would be 16% plus, you know, some additional, you know, 20% of 16% essentially. Am I kind of saying that
Mr.
right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Okay. The data here is reflective of the standard rates, okay. And if you add the differential, those numbers would change.
Okay, thank you.
It doesn't mean they're better, though,
right.
compared to their what they charge.
Understood.
Yes.
Gets a little bit closer to 100%, but only a bit. Okay, Representative Pryor.
Okay, just still following up on this conversation about rates and how much is being compensated. Do you know what the average cost of families is above the maximum rate?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. No. You're asking what's being charged to families, what might be being, we don't. We don't have that data.
Thank you. Looks like there are no other questions right now, so please continue, Ms. Bussing.
Here's just a few examples. We tried to just represent three different areas of the state, showing the center weekly rates. We have a lot of data. There's a large chart available to show all the maximum reimbursement rates for CCAP, but this just represents three counties, Chisago, Nicollet, and Washington. If you're curious, by the way, Washington, we put Washington on here, but all the metro counties have the same maximum rates. Our rates are structured in a cluster methodology, which means that once we get the rates result, we create four clusters of rates, and they typically are geographically similar counties. And so, for instance, the metro counties would all have the same maximum rate structure, and then there's a number of counties aligned with Nicollet County and a number of counties aligned with Chisago County. So the interesting thing about the maximum rate history is because in your handout, there's a history of maximum rate document that goes over the various configurations, if you will, of how maximum rates have been set. Prior to 2003, they were set using language directed and rule that the 75th percentile of the most recent survey, and at that point we did the survey every year. And so the 75th percentile was essentially where rates were at. Since then, there was a freeze in 2003. There have been increases and decreases, and often, if not always, I think there was always language to do a hold harmless. So if we had new data, and the county in question had rates that were perhaps higher than the adjustment that was being made to the rates, We've held the history of that particular rate in that county, and so we still have over 1,500 rates in Minnesota that are tied to the hourly daily rate, you know, that whole chart of our rates, because even though we have four clusters, four types of providers, four rate categories, because we've always been tied to you know, protections in the rates when they've changed to hold harmless, we have quite a complex rate structure.
Ms. Posine, just I guess I have a question about that, about the handout then. Is it looks like that as of 2006, rates were at 75th percentile for most centers, or most providers, 100th percentile for the rest of the very recent survey. So in other words, pretty robust. And then sort of since then, since that 2006, there's been a decline going up and down at different times. But sort of the last time that there was that was at that peak was in 2006. Am I reading that document right?
Well, one key item that doesn't jump out from 2006 is the whichever is less end of that sentence, which is tied back to 2003. So even though there was an increase for some providers, particularly at that point for whatever reason, 100th percentile for some rural programs was called out, because of the freeze in 2003 that lasted till 2005, and then this increase in 2006 had this with whichever is less language, in reality, a number of rates did not go up in 2006.
So, Ms. Posine, if I'm understanding you right, then really it's 2003 we need to look back to for that level of support, essentially.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
So this is to, again, demonstrate what I mentioned before, is that if you took all those prices that were provided, that are reported by providers, and tried to examine what's fully covered by these CCAP maximum rates, you see the downward trend. This ties back to that 16% and 23% slide. So in terms of provider resources, DHS has developed a provider guide. Anybody wants to search for it, we have a eDocs site, when that's where the 5260 reference comes in. It's a fairly big guide, so I didn't bring copies for everybody, but it goes over all the policies, scenarios, how a provider might expect to interact with a local agency, how the policies might impact them. So that's an available resource. We also just recently set up an email subscription service for the Child Care Assistance Program so that we can share information about CCAP specifically to providers serving CCAP families. This has been in place for a while for licensed child care providers, but the universe of licensed child care providers are more than the CCAP providers, and so we set up this listserv recently so that we can send tailored message specifically to providers who have provided their email addresses.
Ms. Posine, Representative Bonner has a question. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Posine, I'm sorry to go back to this. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it and really understand, but on slide 16, you had referenced that the percentage of the provider prices covered by CCAP has continued to decline since 2006. And I'm really trying to understand some of the key factors surrounding that. Is it that we're trying to help more families and we're covering less? Is it that the rates for providers have continued to rise and they're just not keeping up? I mean, what are the critical factors that are driving that disparity?
Ms. Posine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the latter, yes, given that rates have really essentially are tied to such old data, meaning 2011, and essentially even in 2014 when there was some adjustments made to the rates, it, by that point, had not kept up with the market.
And Ms. Poseen, just to, and to confirm from this handout for Representative Bonner that the legislature sets those rates, I guess, and have we just have had this history of the rates that have been set to not keeping up. Am I understanding that right, Ms. Poseen?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Yeah. In 2017, DHS set up a CCAP provider helpline. This was tied to the federal law changes and just a need to be available to providers so that we can answer their questions at a statewide level when providers are curious about how CCAP policies work. So we did establish a phone line. And then we are just now finishing a provider orientation training that will be available for child care assistance providers. It will be offered through DEVELOP and expected to be available in the fall. We're going to pilot it a little bit and then get it posted so that all providers will have that made available to them online. Kind of a supplement to that provider guide that I mentioned. I thought I should just mention a little bit more about the funding. The Child Care and Development Block Grant, CCDBG, is the primary source of federal funding for child care subsidies. At the beginning, I mentioned there's a TANF transfer included in our federal portion. And the CCDBG law was passed in 2014, requiring a substantial number of changes to Minnesota's child care assistance program. The 12-month eligibility was one of them. And more predictable, stable authorizations for families on child care, meaning their co-pays don't change. They can go down if their income goes down, but they don't go up during that 12-month eligibility period, for example, and just that 12-month or, if needed, the 3-month extended eligibility period are the more prominent changes that occurred in 2017, but we didn't get all of the things that we need for federal conformity. So I thought I would just mention those because you'll hear more about them this year, is my guess. That there's a few exceptions right now in the law that don't allow in 12-month eligibility for families getting CCAP. One example is the portability pool. A family who moves from one county to another on the basic sliding fee is not guaranteed 12-month eligibility as long as they, again, remain income eligibility and with their activity. So, unfortunately, a portability pool funded family right now might not reach 12 months and they would be bumped off the program. So that's not in conformity with federal law. Also, MFIP families in certain situations, if they go off their MFIP grant within 1 month instead of 3 months, they are not getting continued child care assistance within 12 months. So those are a couple of items impacting a subset of the CCAP families. We have proposed last year, and these were things that were all in the bill last year that ultimately was not signed, and expedited application for homeless families would help us meet a federal requirement to prioritize services for children who are living in families who are homeless. Probably a notable item, since we've been talking about rates quite a bit, is that the maximum rates by federal law need to be tied to the most recent rate survey, which for us is in 2018. And so since our rates are right now tied to the 2011 survey, we are clearly out of compliance with that item. And then in the federal law, we are, as a state, asked to make sure that there is due process or a formal complaint process or a formal dispute resolution process for providers. And right now, the only time a provider can appeal something formally is if they have an overpayment charge to them. Families have the right to appeal any adverse action impacting their CCAP case, but providers, at least at the formal level, don't have a dispute resolution process.
Ms. Posin, we've got a question for Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I don't know the answer to this. So the federal compliance says that the rates should be the most current data available, and we're using 2011. But there's federal money that comes into this also, and has that money gone up?
Ms. Posin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did receive about $29 million in our 2018 award. That was an increase it was a special allocation aside from the standard allocation added to one of the CCDF grants. And we expect that it will be true in 2019 as well.
And so if I may follow up again, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Pryor.
Is it some money, or is it fair to say that the federal rates now match, or the federal the money that comes from the feds is keeping up with the cost of market rates of child care?
Ms. Posin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so one of the complex interpretations, if you will, of federal law is what they call equal access. And even though the law is very clear about directing states to use the most recent market rate survey data, there is not a clear threshold of what those rates should be compared to the market. So when we refer to the federal law uses the 75th percentile as a benchmark and said that if states achieve that, they would certainly be in compliance. But they don't, the law does not speak to what if you're not. And so states are asked to present data about equal access and define what that means and make a case for are you meeting the market market rates. And so it's a little bit open for interpretation. We just received a corrective action letter from the state, from the federal government for being out of compliance, clearly with the use of the market rate survey data to inform rates. But beyond that, we're not quite sure how the federal government will look at access for Minnesota.
And Ms. Posin, beyond that, what are the consequences of being out of compliance? And besides what you've talked about and not having these good items, but so what's the consequence? Are we receiving, is that what you're saying, we're receiving fewer federal funds because of it? Or like what's the consequence?
Mr. Chair, also a great question. It's not clear yet. A corrective action plan says that we have until September of 2019, so okay, this year, to comply. After that, we are subject to penalties. There's penalty language that speaks to 4%, and I don't know if that's like a minimum, 5% for background studies, 4% for other provisions, but there's also language in the that federal letter that says that the Secretary of HHS can also withhold the entire allocation.
Yep. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know from the public it's going to be a hard sell to do any increases with state dollars to the CCAP program until the fraud in the program is addressed and taken care of. You can't increase the rates knowing that there's millions of dollars being fraudulently accessed. So I've got tons of emails saying do not put one more dime into the CCAP, and there's a movement there that want to end the program. Ending the CCAP program, is that realistic, knowing that it's a federal program?
And I'll just correct, I think, Representative Francis, you mean alleged fraud and things that we don't know but that have been alleged by at least.
No, that's not true. We have reports from the OIG that they've recouped fraudulent dollars.
And I know the Office of Legislative Auditor is taking a look, yeah. But we'll have Ms. Posin provide any comments she wishes to.
Mr. Chair, Representative, CCAP takes fraud very seriously and works very closely with our OIG partners to examine policies and procedures and to identify fraud and make the necessary referrals and train county staff as best we can to understand what their options are. But in terms of federal dollars, certainly, you know, I don't think Minnesota would want to bypass the entire federal program, which is an important support for families and children who are working and in school.
And Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want a clarification. As I heard you say alleged fraud, and since she's here, I just thought I would ask, has there been fraud or is it alleged fraud? Which is it?
And Ms. Posehn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly there is fraud in any public assistance program to some extent. I think what we're trying to get at with the OLA report and examining as many ways as we can what policies or methods can be used to uncover and mitigate it is something we're taking very seriously.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Heintzman.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. So I understand, and I think that most people accept that there is some fraud that occurs in these programs. Are there, I'm assuming with some of the reports, and I'm getting, as I'm just sitting here, all kinds of emails. People must be watching and want to sort of interact to some extent. Are there open investigations? Currently, I'm assuming that we're working on this, that we're trying to make sure that we're pursuing those kinds of issues if they are happening, as you said that they are.
Mr. Chair, Representative, once we get to talking about open investigations, it's really out of my realm as the Child Care Assistance Program Policy Manager, and then we're talking about how OIG or county-level fraud investigators, what's the status of their work right now. And so we're really, so I can't speak on behalf of that at this moment.
Okay, well, so we've got Representative Bonner, and I'll go to Representative Francis. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, I'm curious, before we go too far down the rabbit hole, if you know, and maybe perhaps you do not, but I'm just curious, in terms of what we've been looking at in fraud, do we have any idea of the percentage of the overall budget that we may or may not have found to be potentially fraudulent? I'm just trying to understand the scope of what we're talking about.
Ms. Posehn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a fair question, but you know, we do not. And I think the OLA report may inform us. The issue about fraud is you don't know it's fraud until you know it's fraud. And fraud is not a, you know, there's a definition. You have to go through a process. You have to collect the data. You have to determine what's your course of action for recovery, including criminal proceedings. And so it's, in terms of measuring it, I think the OLA report will probably give us some more information, but I don't think that we're going to have a number that says this amount is fraud. We can say 10 cases, you know, 10 cases so far, or 10 prosecutions have happened so far. But that's, you know, it's going to be a difficult number to manage speaking about.
And Representative Bonner, follow up, and then I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Posehn. So I'm just curious, and this may not be in your purview, to be fair, but I'm curious if you know if during those investigations, if they're doing any analysis to determine whether the fraud is intentional or if it's something as simple as somebody filled out a form incorrectly or didn't understand the process, or I'm just curious if that is evaluated as part of that process.
Ms. Posehn.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative. You're right, I'm not the expert, but I do know enough to know that, you know, there is... When fraud is determined, there has to be that level of intent established. And that's not, it has to reach, you know, certain factors have to go into determining that, and that like a disqualification might occur, and then the provider might argue At that point, I should mention that with disqualifications, that is one method in which CCAP payments can be turned off, which is available across many program areas, which is a disqualification penalty, if you will. And when those do occur, there is a process in which a provider can ask for a hearing about a disqualification, and that might be one way that intent is either refuted or affirmed.
Okay, and Representative Franson, then.
Oh, thank you. And I'm glad that we are on this, what you called, a rabbit hole, because the public deserves some answers. We are unable to get any answers. I have a number of data privacy requests that DHS has gone and just simply ignored. Maybe some of you have seen the commentary that I, along with Representative Matt Dean, submitted to the Star Tribune that was printed in Saturday's paper, updating the public and the state what actually is transpiring within our own government. Okay, many questions are going unanswered. Our government is so corrupt that it hired a group called PFM to investigate our own employees within the OIG department. Okay, and from what I have learned that about the PFM staff, which is a public asset management firm, they have zero experience in this type of investigation. Okay. I don't understand how our government can justify hiring a firm so lacking in experience in this area to perform this type of work, this type of investigation evaluation. So I've got a little, just a simple Google search will bring up, unqualified contractor makes a mess of build it back audit. This is from the Brooklyn paper. And it was also featured in the New York Times. You know who's featured in here? PFM, who has used up to, well, the contract is close to $100,000, I think it's about $90,000, that our government is paying this group, to discredit the work that the OIG employees are doing. Just a simple review of the 2017 annual report, it appears that for the 2016 through 2017, the OIG unit stopped CCAP payments to 7 child care centers due to fraudulent billing, and the total billings payments made to the centers that in the 24 months before their payments were stopped was about $14.5 million. As far as the fraud being intentional, this is a nationwide issue. The plan, the fraud plan, is all the same. You can simply Google different states and go into child care assistance fraud. It's the same exact fraud that is happening in Minnesota, the same game plan. Australia, for crying out loud, too. I read Australia and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is what's happening in our state, in our country. And yet people are just like, we're just not going to pay attention and act like it's not happening. We'll rely on the OLA report, which is going to be awesome because the OLA does wonderful work. However, in the meantime, we are demanding answers. The public wants answers, and we have absolutely nothing. They go unanswered.
And Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the word disqualification came up, and I was just curious, criteria, and then I think that Representative Franson alluded to it, but how many, let's say, you could define a period, whatever might better explain it so that I think myself and the public can understand. So what is that process as a part of my question? And then also, I mean, are we talking about 5 folks that, or providers that have been disqualified, or are we talking about hundreds? What are we talking about here?
Ms. Bosin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that data with me, so I would have to go back. I wasn't prepared today to present on that data, so we can go back and retrieve that kind of data. And also the procedure, I will say in terms of disqualification is one method. Often a county attorney and or OIG staff will consult on the size and scope of a case. And if they, for instance, judge that, decide that a criminal prosecution is the route to go, because disqualifications do just that. They disqualify a program, let's say for a year, And they may want to have more of a penalty than that. So there is some decision-making about what becomes, what goes a disqualification route versus, for instance, a prosecution route. But we can, I can go back and get more information exactly about what a disqualification, how it occurs, and, for instance, in the last few years, what kind of numbers we see.
And Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Are they going to be coming back to the committee to provide that information, or how is that going to work?
And Representative Heintzman, regarding specific questions such as you asked, I would say the department can provide and should provide information to you and to members of the committee as well. The purpose of today, of course, I'll get you in just a second, Representative Franson. The purpose of today, of course, is to lay the foundation, as I said at the very beginning, of making sure that folks on the committee, many of whom are new, are familiar with how the program works, not only one today, but then those on Thursday, et cetera. I'm quite certain that the issues that have been brought up today, most recently in these the last few exchanges, are going to be discussed. I'll just remind committee members and the public that our own auditor is looking into this issue. So there's going to be those opportunities. But I think it's really important that first folks have a foundational knowledge of just what this program is, how it works, and those sorts of details. But if there's specific questions folks have for these particular testifiers, they can provide that information. But I know that we're going to be discussing this, continuing to do that as well. I certainly would expect the OLA report to be coming out while the committee is in the next bit here, and we certainly will be hearing from them as well. So that's my thinking. But Representative Heintzman, any follow-up on that?
Appreciate that. Okay. No, I just wanted to make sure that this seems like a really big issue. This is my first opportunity to hear about a lot of this, and as a new member to this committee, it's kind of shocking. Like I mentioned, the email coming in, and so I know it's something that the public cares about very passionately.
Yes, Representative Heintzman, definitely. And so that's, again, part of the thinking with all these programs is first to make sure folks on the committee have the solid understanding as to how the programs work. And then we start thinking, okay, how can they work better and addressing concerns with them, like the ones that have been discussed. And I would also say the concerns about that have been discussed in the past bunch of slides about the fact that, you know, it's only covering 16% of the cost for family child care centers. No wonder that we're losing family child care providers all around the state. So I know Representative Morrison, was there something specific on that, Representative Franson? Otherwise, Representative Morrison was next, and then I think you'd be after her. Okay, good. Representative Morrison, then we'll come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Ms. Pocin. So I just want to understand, you say currently you take care of about 30,000 children. I'm wondering how that has changed over the past 5 to 10 years, if that number is bigger or smaller.
Ms. Pocin.
I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers exactly with me. It's not very different.
Okay.
But I can actually provide.
Okay, that would be great.
The full set of numbers.
I'm just concerned that we're disincentivizing people to take these children on with the reimbursement rates that we're setting. So I was wondering if the numbers had declined.
Okay, Ms. Pocin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, like I said, generally the numbers for children and families haven't changed much, but as you can see, that the amount of rates that were cut, the dollar value of the rates has decreased, and so how we're serving families, I guess you could say, has changed, but the numbers of kids themselves is not that very different.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franson.
Thank you. So one more thing. I'm hoping that you will bring Ms. Carolyn Hamm, who is the Inspector General that oversees the OIG employees. I hope you bring her very soon in front of our committee so we can ask these questions that she is simply ignoring via data practice requests. I have somewhere in here, the plan of PFM of their when they were supposed to release different reports. I know for sure, oh yes, here it is. And that report is done. I know that DHS has a copy of the report from PFM. I've asked for a copy of that report. I think if the public has paid up to $100,000 for that report, we all have a right to see that report. Sadly, what I think is what's going to happen is they're going to wait, the department is going to wait until CCAP or the OLA has released the report on the child care assistance program. Then PFM will make some edits and just to do harm to our own good employees that are doing the work of what they were hired to do was to find the fraud, investigate the fraud, and turn it into law enforcement for them to take over from there. So, Mr. Chair, can we get Carolyn Hamm up here so she can answer the data privacy request that she is not answering via the mail or however she wants to answer them?
Representative Franson, so I sat through the full three-hour hearing that you had in December regarding this issue, and so I'm familiar with that, and had the chance to question at that point. The OLA report is being developed right now. My understanding from the testimony from Mr. Nobles, even at the time, was that the department was being very cooperative. You know, we're going to see what the how things work regarding the committee. It's important to me to address this issue. I serve as a prosecutor, as you're aware, outside the legislature, and I'm quite concerned about any allegations of wrongdoing. I will say I'm also concerned about the kind of severe underfunding the program has apparently had through the years as well. And so I have concerns, but I absolutely am concerned about this, and I want to make sure that we address it. Representative Franson.
Well, Mr. Chair, perhaps we would not have an underfunding in the program. The fraud was taken care of.
Representative Franson, thank you. And again, I have great concerns, and I serve my work outside the legislature, absolutely addressing wrongdoing. And it's a great concern to me that funds would be taken away from folks who are deserving them by anybody who is not. And so we absolutely need to address this. So I can assure you we'll be addressing it quite a bit. The first step is to make sure that at least folks on the committee understand how the program works. And that's what happens today, and then we move on from there. But I can assure you that I take it quite seriously, and I want to continue to work with you and with others to address it. Other questions that folks have? I just have one that came out of this. How many providers right now are receiving CCAP, Ms. Pacina? What proportion of providers are, in fact, receiving funding under this program?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the early slide mentioned about 3,300 providers in a given month are reimbursed by CCAP. And let me just see, excuse me 1 minute. There's always a difference between registered providers, meaning providers willing to accept CCAP, versus in a given month, those that are receiving a payment for CCAP. The latest information right now, we're just finishing 2018, but for 2017, we had a monthly average of about 900 centers serving CCAP children, 440 license-exempt centers, about 1,800 licensed family providers, 302 legal non-licensed providers.
And I guess, Ms. Pusine, I'm just wondering, so proportionally, though, are we talking about, you know, half of providers in the state or a quarter or three quarters or just order of magnitude?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a little over 80% of the licensed centers in 2017 participated in CCAP. License-exempt centers, we don't have good data because we only track those that are paid by CCAP. Licensed family providers, it was about a third of the licensed family child care providers in Minnesota. And, of course, legal non-licensed as well. We don't have a comparison point for that.
So you said about a third of family, licensed family child care.
We're registered to serve a CCAP family.
Thank you. Okay. No further questions right now. I know... So I guess please continue with your presentation. I'm not sure if your colleague has taken over the next portion or.
Yes, Deb Swenson-Klatt will join us or replace me. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Please proceed. If you can just fully identify yourself and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt. I'm the manager of Child Development Services at the Department of Human Services. We sit in the Child Care Services Division alongside the Child Care Assistance Program. You've invited us here today to speak to and provide an overview of five different grant programs that show up in the state general fund budget as related to child care quality and supports for families looking for child care. So I am happy today to provide a brief overview of each of these. I appreciate this opportunity to share with you this an overview of these range of programs. Different than the CCAP program, these services actually are available to all Minnesota families with children seeking child care and to all Minnesota licensed child care providers, of which there are about 9,800 in the state, and indeed all members of the child care workforce, of which we estimate there to be about 35,000 individuals working in child care settings. As I move through the overview, I'll note the funding amounts for each of these five state-funded grant programs, but you'll see both state and federal funding for each. We want you to understand that there are these two sources of funding, state and federal, supporting each of these grant activities, and indeed the Child Care Development Block Grant or Child Care Development Fund is the primary funding source that supports these activities around quality and consumer education for parents, as is the case in the Child Care Assistance Program. But also one of the programs I'll mention, the Migrant Child Care Program, is supported by a different federal funding stream, the Social Services Block Grant, or Title 20, and I'll just touch on that as well. In with respect to both of these federal block grants, the these five state-funded programs help us meet the requirements of the federal programs and are used as a match for the block grant. So the first program, grant program I'll cover is the Child Care Facility Grant Program. This grant is a critical piece of our agency's strategy for addressing child care, Minnesota's child care shortage. As you might know, demand for child care in Minnesota currently outweighs the supply of child care, and the lack of quality child care, especially in greater Minnesota, has a tangible economic impact on many communities. Communities with an adequate supply of child care are better positioned to attract and retain employees and support the families in those communities. So this program is actually a single grant that provides critical services to help communities address their child care shortages and for child care programs to start up or expand their programs and better manage their child care businesses. This program is authorized in state law under 119B.25 and began in 1997. The funding in state fiscal year 18 included $163,000 in state general funds, at, with total funding for the grant at a little over $523,000. Just a little bit about what this grant program does and the impact it has. In state fiscal year 18, 10 communities received help from the grantee to address their child care shortages through a strategic planning process that resulted in indeed increased spaces or slots in their communities. 55 child care businesses received business technical assistance, and 351 child care professionals or individuals received business training. First Children's Finance is the name of the grantee that receives these grant funds. DHS recently, as required for grant contracts, RFP'd the grant contract, and so it's going through a recompetition at this point. We'll award a new grant beginning July of 2019. The next grant program are our Minnesota's Child Care Resource and Referral Grants. So the resource and referral system in Minnesota also is known as Child Care Aware. That might be a name that is more familiar to you. It is also a key part of the state's infrastructure for helping families find child care, when they need it and supporting childcare providers in improving their quality. The system is also a critical way in which we're addressing the childcare shortage in the state. We know that the quality improvement supports that are provided help stabilize early care and education settings, and the training and professional development that this system provides to our childcare provider workforce is a critical service in equipping these individuals to work in childcare settings and provide the safe, stable, quality childcare that the children in their care need. This system is made up of 18 local grantees serving all economic development regions in the state and one statewide coordinating office or organization, and the grantees range are from a range of nonprofit organizations and one technical college. The system provides four things: childcare information and referrals to families, as I mentioned, professional development and financial supports to the childcare workforce, small grants to childcare programs, and I'll talk a little bit more about those grants in a minute on the next slide. And then this system, the childcare aware system, is a key part of the set of organizations and grantees helping to operate and implement Parent Aware, our quality rating and improvement system for Minnesota's providers and families. The child care resource and referral system is authorized under in state law under 119B.19 and began in 1986. The fiscal year, state fiscal year 18 funding for the program included a little over $1 million in state general funds. And the total funding, supported in large part by the Child Development Block Grant, is $6.78 million. Last year, the system served tens of thousands of families through an online and in-person child care search support. Over 73,000 attendees participated in child care trainings offered through the Child Care Aware system, and almost 500 professionals received scholarships for higher education degrees or credentials and incentives to work to stay in their child care setting as a retention strategy. DHS recently also issued an RFP for one of the 19 organizations, as it, again, is required, and will in order to recompete that that grant award, and will we have the intent of recompeting the remaining grants for awards starting July 2021. The Child Care Service Development Grants are the grant program I just mentioned that the Child Care Aware system administers that provides small grants to child care providers across Minnesota to help them improve the quality of their care and to, again, also address the child care shortage. These grants are used for a variety of purposes. They are a critical source of funding for the programs that are able to access them in either starting up, expanding, or improving their quality. So they provide a direct influx of funding in the form of a small grant award to childcare programs. The program is authorized under 119B.21. It began in 1989. And funding in state fiscal year 18 included $250,000 in state general funds, with a total allocation of $1.274 million, again, supported by our Child Care Development Fund. These small grants are administered locally by the Child Care Aware agencies around the state. The funding for these small grants is included in the contracts for these local Child Care Aware agencies. So it's really pass-through funding for our child care provider community who are interested in the grants. Last year, these local Child Care Aware organizations awarded 754 grants to child care providers around the state. DHS is aware that this program can be burdensome in some ways for childcare providers to apply for. The statutory language is a bit complex. It's an area that we're interested in addressing and streamlining, and so I'll just call that to the committee's attention. The next program, Parent Aware Grants, is in a way an effort to address the supply gap from a different perspective. Here, a core focus of Parent Aware is to increase the supply of quality childcare and, importantly, also to address the educational achievement gap among children in Minnesota. There are gaps in educational achievement, as you likely know, between Black and Hispanic versus white children and between low-income children and children of higher incomes. These educational achievement gaps are caused at least in part by gaps in educational opportunity. And DHS is helping to address these gaps through this strategy of supporting childcare programs in improving their childcare quality. Parent Aware is also a key parent education tool with families, providing families with information that they can easily search for the programs that volunteer for a Parent Aware quality rating. That information for families is easily available on parentaware.org, which is this consumer website available for all Minnesota families to search for childcare and rating information. Before I have a brief video to show you, but I'll say a few more words about the program. Parent Aware is authorized in state law under 124D.142 in 2009 after a pilot of several years. The funding in state fiscal year 18 is $1.75 million in state general funds with a total funding of $10.25 million. Our grantees and contractors supporting Parent Aware include the child agencies that I described a few minutes ago, along with other nonprofits and institutions of higher education that help us to administer the program. Today, almost 2,800 childcare and early education programs are Parent Aware rated. This represents about 27% of the eligible programs in the state. And one important measure of impact that we track regularly at the department is the percentage of children receiving child care assistance, ages 0 to 5, and not yet in kindergarten, who are attending a Parent Aware rated program. We're interested here in seeing the children in these low-income families who are receiving this public support also receiving high-quality care through a Parent Aware rated program. So today, 54% of children 0 to 5 in CCAP are in a Parent Aware rated program, up from 34% in 2014.
And Ms. Swenson-Clatt, I think we've got a question for Representative Cortizo-Bitumen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if you could speak briefly to the process of becoming Parent Aware rated and what our child care providers have to do. Is there any type of ongoing requirement, and does the state have capacity to increase this 27% up to 100%? Is that our goal?
Ms. Swenson-Clatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, great questions. The process for becoming Parent Aware rated for a child care program depends on whether the program holds a current accreditation by a national accrediting body or not. So if accredited, we provide an accelerated pathway for the program because we know that the program has already demonstrated that they're meeting quality standards through that accreditation that are equivalent to a high Parent Aware rating. For a child care program that's not accredited, we have a process where the program does indeed demonstrate how they are doing relative to a range of measures of quality. They do that through submitting documentation to us in writing. And for child care centers, we have in place an on-site observation that's a part of the rating process as well. Programs can come into Parent Aware, begin participating in Parent Aware during a phase where they can simply get ready for a rating. And during that time, they can receive a small grant to help them improve quality. And they're also receiving coaching from our child care aware agencies on the ground. Once they're ready for a rating, they're entering a rating cohort, which occurs every 6 months. They're submitting, they go through that cohort, submitting their rating information, and if indeed a center, they'll receive the observation, and then the rating is issued at the end of that time period. We believe we have the, our goal is not to rate 100% of Minnesota's child care programs. Many are not eligible for a Parent Aware rating because they might, because inclusive in our full range of child care programs are school age care programs, and this program is aimed at improving the quality of care for programs serving children 0 to 5. We do have a goal of reaching about 65% of children receiving CCAP through or serving them through a Parent Aware rated program. That's one way to think about it. Whether or not we have capacity to get there, I think is a complex question. We think we have the capacity right now to do more, and we're continuing to see an uptick in the number of ratings in this current year.
And then Representative France has a question.
Yes.
Okay, so first off, I just want to put on record that the best determinant of quality isn't exactly a star rating from the government, but parents themselves are the best determinant of the quality and the type of care that they want for their children. My question is, the what percentage of public schools or government-funded programs is the 50% of that CCAP, or the 50% of the Parent Aware? How many of those are publicly funded?
Ms. Winston-Clark.
Of that 54%. And the same, if you have the scholarship number, too, I'm wondering if you have that, too.
Ms. Winston-Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, you're raising in your question, I think, a helpful point. Parent Aware provides ratings not just to licensed childcare programs in Minnesota, but also to Head Start and public school pre-K programs. So I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're asking how many of the total rated programs are public school-based programs. At the end of 2018, this is the data I have in front of me, of the 2,800 programs rated, 736 were public school pre-K programs, and 284 were Head Start programs. The remainder of the 2,800 programs rated are child care programs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I have a follow-up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, so that's about half of that is going to the public school programs or to Head Start, right, of the 2,800?
I think, Representative Franzen, no. I think it's about 1,000 out of 2,800, if I'm doing that math right,
yeah.
Representative Swenson-Clatt.
Okay.
So Mr. Chair, Representative Clatt.
A third, I guess.
So about 1,800 are private-owned businesses?
Ms. Swenson-Clatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct.
Okay. And then how many private-owned businesses do we have in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Swenson-Clatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are 9,800 licensed child care programs in the state of Minnesota currently, both child care centers and family child care.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Franzen. Ms. Swenson-Clatt, and you've got just about 2 minutes left here, Ms. Swenson-Clatt, for
all right, Mr.
everything
Chair,
we're getting to. I don't know how long the video is, but we may.
It is, Mr. Chair, committee members, the video is very short, okay. So I will move on to that.
Parent Parent Aware for me is a way to make a difference in offering quality care for children.
A lot of times providers are kind of by themselves. They're all day with children. And so it's just nice to have an additional set of eyes to come in.
I offer a structured program, but I'm there to support their play. And I wanted to connect with Parent Aware, but I also didn't want to lose who I was. It's the most amazing success story for me personally right now.
Okay. You've got, looks like just one more slide, Ms. Swenson-Clatt, and again, we'll have you hit it pretty quick if you can.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the final program to briefly describe is our Migrant Child Care Program in Minnesota. This program is another example of how we are addressing the educational achievement gap in our state. The program serves children of migrant workers and helps those children access quality child care through a Parent Aware rated Head Start, child care center, or family child care setting. This is the program that is funded with a small percentage of social services block grant funds, designated for migrant child care, authorized under 256.5 in state statute, and has been in place since the early 70s. You can see on the slide the funding appropriation. The number of children served last fiscal year was 663.
Thank you. I think Representative Cortese Watoon has a real quick question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I used to work with migrant families in the state of Wisconsin. I would venture a guess that many of our migrant workers here in Minnesota are working agricultural as well as manufacturing jobs that happen out of the school year, out of school hours. It's a really important program. Can you speak to the educational or the outreach activity that we do here in the state that allows them to understand this grant that's accessible?
Ms. Winter-Clatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, this program does indeed serve families of migrant families who are working in the agricultural sector in greater Minnesota. The grantee is Tri-Valley Opportunity Council based out of Crookston, but the children served are throughout the Red River Valley and down through the southern part of the state where we most see agricultural workers. The outreach that Tri-Valley does is indeed happens through all kinds of mechanisms. I was up visiting the St. Cloud site last spring and heard from the staff there that they do outreach into the community by visiting local parks, connecting to the housing, reaching out to where migrant families are living, through other social services, but they are actively always working to reach families throughout the growing season because migrant families are coming into the state and then exiting at all different times of the growing season.
Thank you. Mr. Berg, I just want to clarify, these grant programs all run through the DHS budget. Is that right, the ones that Ms. Swenson-Clatt's been talking about?
Mr. Chair, with the exception of the Parent Aware, is actually through the K-12 budget.
Okay. MD, even though it's administered through DHS. Okay.
Mr. Chair, the funding gets transferred over to DHS administratively after the appropriation. The Parent Aware gets appropriated in K-12.
And then I'm going to toss something out to have you not answer now, but maybe you can email us an answer and we'll send it out via the committee listserv so the public is aware as well. But I know the DEED has some grants that seem pretty similar to this, and I guess I'd be interested about the interaction, if any, between these and those in DEED. Again, I want to cut things off, but if you can send a response and we'll send that out to the committee listserv. And if folks who are watching are not on that that distribution list, please get it. Please sign up. You'll notice members and members of the public, there's a handout on early learning programs and early care and development that includes CCAP and many other programs as well. This will kind of be a guide for us in some of the programs we're receiving background on. And that leads to our next hearing on Thursday, which will be some of the programs operated by MDE, which may continue the following week as well. But we're trying to lay the foundation so we have the good information we need to then make decisions. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.